From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Macaulay Culkin. The film Home Alone made him a star. By the age of 8, he was already being hounded by the paparazzi. After a few other movies, including a Home Alone sequel, Culkin dropped out of the industry to go to high school. Last year, he returned to film with his starring role in Party Monster as a gay club kid who murders his drug dealer. Now in the new film comedy Saved, he's playing a skeptic in an evangelical Christian high school. We'll also talk with the movie's director and co-writer, Brian Donnelly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Preparations are underway for the United States Capitol to receive the body of former President Ronald Reagan. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The legislative schedule has been wiped clean for the week. Lawmakers in the House had planned to focus on a massive energy bill and the Senate on the defense funding bill. Instead, the House will take up two measures, one to authorize the use of the Capitol Rotunda for Mr. Reagan's body to lie in state, and a resolution honoring the life and legacy of the 40th president. Mr. Reagan's body will arrive by horse-drawn caisson at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday afternoon. After a congressional ceremony, his body will lie in state until Friday morning. As many as 100,000 citizens are expected to pay their last respects to the president in the Capitol Rotunda. On Friday morning, Mr. Reagan's casket will be taken to the National Cathedral for his state funeral and then back to his presidential library in California for burial. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
Iraq's new prime minister, Iyad Alawi, announced today that 9 Iraqi factions have agreed to disband their militias. Alawi said the deal would allow more than 100,000 armed men to return to civilian life or to join Iraq's security forces. The deal doesn't include the militia loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, which has been fighting U.S. troops for more than 2 months. The government program would treat former militia members as veterans, making them eligible for pensions, job placement services, and other government benefits. The U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for some 4.5 million Mexican trucks to carry cargo throughout the United States. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
For more than 2 decades, Congress barred Mexican trucking throughout the U.S. because of safety and environmental concerns about aging Mexican trucks with deficient pollution controls. But under the North American Free Trade Agreement, the U.S. agreed to phase in Mexican trucking, and 3 years ago, President Bush ordered the lifting of the moratorium on Mexican trucks. Consumer, environmental, and health organizations went to court to stop it, claiming that the administration had illegally disregarded the nation's environmental laws by failing to conduct a full environmental impact study. A federal appeals court agreed, but today the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the federal law does not require such a study. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. and Britain are hoping to get a vote on their proposed resolution on Iraq in the U.N. Security Council tomorrow. The latest draft of the resolution could run into opposition from France, which wants the interim Iraqi government to have veto power over any major military operation by the U.S.-led occupation force. In stocks today, the Dow gained 146 points to close at 10,389. The Nasdaq was up 42 to 2020. This is NPR News. More harsh weather hit North Texas overnight, where thousands of residents were already dealing with last week's severe thunderstorm damage. 10,000 homes and businesses are without power. Bill Zeeble reports from member station KERA in Dallas.
High winds and heavy thunderstorms pummeled parts of Denton, Jack, and Tarrant counties, which include sections of Fort Worth. 3 to 6 inches of fast-falling rain swelled creeks and riverbeds, submerging some cars and lifting others off the road. Stranded drivers got help from rescuers, with no injuries reported from last night. Flooding got so bad at times, officials closed a major highway in North Fort Worth. Near-hurricane-strength winds of about 70 miles an hour toppled trees and power lines. Hours earlier, the local utility had finally restored power to some 500,000 households that lost electricity less than a week ago. This time, power losses were not nearly as severe. More rain is predicted over the next few days. For NPR News, I'm Bill Siebel in Dallas.
The Pentagon is planning to cut the number of U.S. troops in South Korea by one-third. U.S. military officials in Seoul announced today that the 37,000-member U.S. force in South Korea will be cut by 12,500. The U.S. delegation said the troop cuts won't hurt the defense of South Korea because the U.S. plans to upgrade its weapons systems in the south. The troop reduction will include about 3,600 soldiers who've already received orders to redeploy to Iraq this summer. Some South Korean politicians worried that the U.S. troop reduction would embolden North Korea to press harder for concessions in security talks with the South. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 18 to close at 1140. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, committed to providing its associates a variety of career paths, training resources, and advancement opportunities. Information at walmartstores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you haven't seen Macaulay Culkin since the Home Alone era, you may be surprised by the kind of offbeat, independent movies that he's making and what a good adult actor he's developed into. Last year, he starred in Party Monster, based on the story of Michael Alec, a New York club kid who gave wild parties and is now serving time for killing his drug dealer. Now Culkin is starring in the new film Saved, a comedy set in a Christian high school called American Eagle. The film was produced by Michael Stipe's company, Single Cell. A little later, we'll hear from Brian Donnelly, the movie's director and co-writer. The story revolves around the girls in the school's Christian rock band. Jenna Malone plays a girl who tries to save her boyfriend's soul by helping him prove he's not really gay. Unfortunately, she becomes pregnant in the process. Mandy Moore plays the school's most preachy Christian. Macaulay Culkin plays her skeptical brother. As a result of a childhood accident, he needs a wheelchair to get around. He becomes close with the school rebel, who is also the school's only Jewish student, played by Eva Amori. In this scene, Culkin and Amori are talking at an outdoor cafe just across the street from the Planned Parenthood office.
What's the matter? I'm scared to be seen in public with a stripper.
No, I'm scared of being seen with a cripple.
I've been seen with worse.
Hillary Faye's gonna freak out when I'm not there waiting for her.
Who cares?
It's just that I don't get out much on my own.
I'm not really a stripper, you know.
I'm not really a Christian. So, how'd you end up at American Eagle? I mean, you're Jewish, right?
Well, after I got expelled from my last school, it was either here or homeschooling. I figured I could handle these freaks better than my parents.
Well, lucky me.
Are you playing footsies with me?
Wheelies.
Hey, isn't that
Mary? What is she doing downtown?
Well, there's only one reason Christian girls come down to the Planned Parenthood.
She's planning a pipe bomb?
Okay, two reasons.
I asked Macaulay Culkin why he wanted to be part of the film Saved.
I mean, it was just such a smart movie. It was just so smart and funny, and I just loved how it approached issues, and I loved just the structure of it. I love the fact that it kind of, you know, all these characters start off as these kind of, you know, almost cliches or caricatures almost of teen movies or of Christianity even. I love how they kind of break down or are torn down throughout the course of the film, and it kind of exposed for what they really are. And I just love the subject matter. I mean, I'm not a very, very religious person, but at the same time, I was one of those people who was, I was raised Catholic, which means I'm an ex-Catholic. But, you know, went to Catholic school, you know, math, English, Jesus Christ. It's kind of a part of the curriculum. And so, you know, it's just something that's, you know, I've always found interesting. So, yeah, just wanted to be a part of it. And I met Brian Donnelly, the director, once I got back to America, and he was just, you know, he really got it. He was so cute. You know, he's a first-time guy. And he had this little notebook of, you know, his vision of the movie. And, you know, he had cut, you could tell, I could just totally picture him sitting Indian style in his living room with a pair of scissors and magazines cutting out pictures and stuff. And, you know, he had pictures of Jenna in there, and he had pictures of me and other potential cast members. He even had, like, a spec, like, poster for the movie. It was really kind of cute. And it was just kind of one of those moments where I think we kind of just both acknowledged that, you know, we had the same idea in mind, that we wanted to make the same movie, and it was just kind of, and kind of went from there.
What did you relate to about the character that you play in Saved?
Well, I love, you know, he was very cynical. because he, you know, he's in a wheelchair in the movie, and his older sister, or actually younger sister, Hilary Faye, played by Mandy Moore, is always kind of wheeling him around like he's some sort of merit badge. Like, you know, look how good of a Christian I am. I take care of my brother who's in a wheelchair. And it kind of exposes him to the manipulative aspects of religion, of Christianity. And so he rejects it, basically. And I think by the end, he kind of comes full circle, and he eventually kind of ends up finding how he's right with Jesus, basically, and how and finding his religion.
Did you end up going to Christian schools or Christian concerts as research for the film?
Yeah, Brian Danley, he's very big into research. I mean, you should see all the things that we got. I mean, just printouts from websites and things like that, conversations he was having with other Christians who had read the script. And he even sent me some pamphlets on how paraplegics have intercourse. Not that it's ever addressed in the movie. He just wanted to make sure that, you know, I knew that my character had a very healthy sex life and things like that. It was very cute. But one of the things that we always did was we went to Christian rock concerts, Christian, you know, youth rallies, things like that. And it was amazing. Because I remember when I read the script, you know, I kind of was aware that this world was going on, that there is this kind of modern Christian movement going on. But to see it firsthand, it just made us all the more want to stay true to it. We went to this big one at Edison Field, you know, at our Anaheim Stadium, wherever the Angels play in Anaheim. And it was 40,000 born-again Christians who were all blonde, by the way. All born-again Christians are blonde. And it was amazing. I mean, it was like these Christian rock bands, like the U2 sound-alike Christian rock band and the Radiohead sound-alike Christian rock band, and all very uplifting songs. And the pastor's up there, and he's quoting Pink and Madonna as much as the Bible. It was quite amazing. And I remember, you know, I was walking out of there, and it was just, you know, it was a kind of this odd experience. And there were all these people picketing outside. I couldn't believe there was people picketing and passing out all these pamphlets saying, oh, you're choosing the wrong path, and, you know, so-and-so is the Antichrist or whatever. And I remember, and they were Christians. They were like fundamentalists, like Christians who were kind of just against the concept of Christian rock music or whatever. And, you know, it was just odd to me that the Christians were picketing each other. And I just remember I turned to one of my castmates and said, you know, if these Christians are picketing each other, what makes us think we can get away with making this movie, which is kind of an odd satire on them.
What have you found so far? Did you go to any of the screenings, any of the advanced screenings?
I've kind of been hearing more and, you know, reading some of the kind of advanced, I don't know, either reviews or opinions or whatever. It's interesting. The people who are represented in the movie, kind of the new wave Christians a bit, they're actually kind of digging it. They see it for what it is. But, yeah, no, some of the fundamental, I mean, you should see. I just came off of a press tour in a junket, and one of the things, you know, so I've fielded basically every single question I could possibly field about, you know, my faith and just the movie in general. And one of the things this guy pulled out was like a printout from this Christian website or something. It was saying about the movie, it was saying, oh, you know, this is going to drive kids to suicide. This is the reason why teenage mothers have abortions and things like that. And it was just really sad because you could tell the person obviously had not seen the movie. It's kind of very sad that these people, that some people felt the need to go out there and say those things, just because from the surface we're dealing with these issues. We're dealing with teenage mothers and homosexuality. So, of course, you know. But overall, I think, you know, like the Catholics love it, of course, you know. But, yeah, I think overall, I think, you know, it's getting a pretty good reaction from everyone.
Okay, so you go to this stadium concert with around, what, 40,000?
It's like 40,000 born-again Christians. I mean, it's all types.
Okay,
like I
right.
said, there was like, you know, there was like goth Christians there. They were like, you know, kids with like dyed black hair and like, you know, crucifix tattooed on the back of their hands and things. I mean, really all types. It was interesting.
What was the reaction to you? Didn't people recognize you?
Yeah, it was very odd. It's not that normal, like, hey, can you do the face? Or, you know, can I have your autograph or something like that? No, I mean, it was actually like, it was this interesting reaction of just like, they were sincerely happy to see me there. They just like, they almost thought I was one of them or something, you know, they kind of, but it was this kind of really cool thing where they're just like, yeah, you're here. Well, you know, enjoy the show. And it was just like, there was this odd feeling of just like, you know, I've just kind of, they just wanted me to be there. You know, they didn't want anything from me other than my presence and my, you know, I don't know, my faith, I guess.
Well, I have to say, I think you've made such really interesting and, in a way, daring choices in the movies that you've decided to make as an adult.
Thank you.
You know, you took like a hiatus of, I don't know, 8 or 9 years away from
something like
acting.
That, yeah.
Then you did a play on the West End in London,
mm-hmm.
and then your reemergence in movies was Party Monster, in which you played a gay, drug-addicted club kid who becomes so addled he murders his drug dealer. Let me play a short clip from the movie, and this comes from early in the film when you're doing a voiceover narration telling the viewers about the story of your life. And your narration intersects a little bit with your mother's description of your childhood.
Hi, I'm Michael. I grew up in the Midwest. Usual story, felt different, really didn't fit in. But I wasn't going to turn the other cheek. No siree. I started selling candy in school. Jacked up the prices several 100%.
This is my Michael. He was always making money. He had a knack for it. Yeah. My little candy man.
Let's see. What else? Oh. Once when I was 10, my Sunday school teacher took me back to his house. He taught me how to French kiss, among other things.
He really took my boy under his wing. Very nice man.
His mother caught us in the basement. And she screamed, "I told you not to bring them here." And he said, "Don't, you'll frighten them away."
One night, Michael gave me a goodnight kiss that a little boy should not give his mother.
I thought everyone kissed like that.
Now, you look and sound so different in this movie than, say, in your child movie era. I'm interested in that kind of voice that you got for the film.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, because we were playing real people. We kind of really tried to stay true to who they were. I mean, there's kind of certain rules that apply to playing a character like that, because you want to try your best to talk like them. You want to try your best to move like them and things like that. And these people were very, very specific about the way they talked and the way that they just kind of moved their arms and things. And so we kind of had to play within those rules, basically. But, yeah, me and Seth just went out there. And I remember when he first signed on to it, because we kind of talked about doing this and we kind of had a plan about how we're going to prepare and how we're going to just do all these things. And
this is Seth Green, you're a co-star.
Seth Green, my co-star. And so, yeah, he calls me up on the phone. He goes, hi, Michael, it's James. You know, I was in New York, but I'm sorry I missed you. And blah, 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 blah. You know, he kind of just leaves you with this message in like a dead-on James St. James impression. I couldn't believe it. Actually, I listened to it on the phone and replayed the tape, and I couldn't believe it. And I was like, gosh, I got to get on my game, too. So I started kind of messing around with the voice and basically playing repeat after me games with the VCR and, you know, any kind of footage I can get of him, and went to a voice person to kind of just literally kind of almost phonetically write out some of the stuff. But, you know, just talk like Michael, you know, James. And I called him up. I'm like, James, I'm sorry I missed you when you were in town. You crazy, you know, and just like sending all these weird, you know, like voice messages to each other. It was fun, you know, and we really just wanted, like I said, we wanted to talk like them and move like them as much as possible, but at the same time, not make caricatures of them. And at the same time, you wanted enough creative freedom within the characters to maneuver and do kind of whatever you felt was appropriate for storytelling. So it's a fine line you tread, but I think we pulled it off all right.
My guest is Macaulay Culkin. He's starring in the new movie Saved. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Macaulay Culkin, and he's started making movies again after an 8 or 9 year hiatus. And he starred in Party Monster, a movie based on the true story of Michael Alleg, and now he's starring in Saved, which is set at a Christian high school. One of the things I found really interesting about your portrayal of Michael Alleg in Party Monster is that in one respect, he's the opposite of you. And here's what I mean. You become a star at the age of, what, 8 or something? 10?
Yeah, basically.
You know, in Home Alone. And by the time you were 14, you wanted out of that whole star-making machinery stuff. You wanted to stop acting, and you wanted out of show business, at least for a while. And whereas he comes to New York and he wants to be a star. I mean, he is living to be famous. He is living to be seen.
No, he spent his entire life running towards fame. And I spent half my life running away from it.
Well, as someone who was a star as a child and who wanted to leave that whole thing, Did you understand what being famous, what being a star would mean to somebody like Michael Alec? Did you understand what it meant to be desperate or why somebody would want it?
It's interesting because I truly don't understand fame. I kind of just accept it. You know, I've been doing this, I've been doing this since I was 4 years old, and it's just, it's 19 years now. And, for a while there, from when I was about 8 years old on, I was playing the game at a pretty high level overall. And so, I don't know. It wasn't like I was consciously saying to myself, I want to be famous. It was just kind of like, I had a lot of energy and I enjoyed the attention that came with being on stage. And it wasn't about the attention that came, not all the other attention, like, photographers hiding in your bushes. I could definitely do without that and could have done even when I was 8 years old without that. Like I said, fame had nothing to do with it with me. So it was kind of fun to get in there and kind of just, why would he want that? Where does this come from? It was coming from this kind of, this almost need to fit in almost. And he kind of took it to this hyper reality basically and created his own world where he was famous, Because in that world, you have to understand back in the club days, back in after Andy Warhol basically passed on, the club scene was basically dead. Before, you go to these clubs and like, oh, look, there's Liza Minnelli. Or oh, look over there, there's Cher, And that was kind of the way it was. But now they were all gone. All these kind of club idols were gone. And so Michael kind of swept in and created these celebrities basically. Basically just said, I'm famous because I say so. And I have absolutely no substance to me whatsoever, but that doesn't matter because I'm famous. And it's just this weird concept that, the celebrity without a cause kind of thing, It's just like, famous because I say so. And you have to understand that all these people were coming from this world, like this high school world, basically, where, insiders and outsiders. And they were definitely the outsiders. They were homosexuals. They didn't dress right. They didn't look right. There was a lot of things wrong with them. And so then now they come to New York City and they're the kings of the clubs. Now all the people, all those like people who played high school football and all those people who were really cool in high school were now standing outside of their clubs wanting to get into their world. And they were kind of turned the tables in the entire world and said, No, you're not in. You're not allowed into our little world. And it was interesting. It was kind of more coming from that than almost a need to be like, famous and on the cover of magazines. It was more kind of just turning the tables on the entire world.
Now, you mentioned that when you were 8, you already had tabloid photographers hiding out in the bushes.
Essentially, yeah.
Well, man, what was that experience like as the age of 8 to have the paparazzi lying in wait for you?
It was weird. It's almost, at this point, it's almost like I don't know any better, almost. It was definitely odd, and I definitely have I just have defense mechanisms, in my mind. Just whenever, I'm always, every time I'm outside, I'm always kind of checking out the horizon, seeing if there's anything weird out there, I know I can recognize a paparazzi by his bag, I swear to God. It's terrible. And so, I don't know, it's just the way it is, and I accept it, and I try my best to protect myself. And that was one of the reasons why I went away for so long, was that I didn't want to deal with that stuff. And even when I wasn't working, they were still out there, and they were still kind of interested in some perverted kind of, way. And so I just tried my best to protect myself and kind of just stay away from it and try my, I just try my best not to have my life end up as tabloid fodder because, that's not what it is, I just live my life. And it's so funny when someone's a celebrity, even the most normal aspects of the life become crazy. There's so many things about my life that are crazy. It's like, I remember when I got married, it was such a big deal. It was so, wow, isn't he nuts? And it's just like, I was just doing anything a normal human being would do. I went to high school. I fell in love. I married the girl. Big deal, But it's just so funny. This is a story I was actually just telling someone before that, like not even an hour ago. I went to the Michael Jackson big reunion kind of concert he had. It was like 2-3 years ago or something like that. And I brought a friend of mine with me. And I introduced her to Michael. And it was this fun kind of this, average exchange. She goes, hi, nice to meet you. And he goes, hi, And he goes, hey, it looks like rain tonight. I hope it doesn't rain. And, my friend is like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And so after the conversation, I was talking to my friend. She goes, he's so weird. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you introduced me. And then he starts talking about the rain. I'm like, he was talking about the weather. I'm like, there's nothing more normal than that in the entire world. Actually, I think that was one of the most normal things he's done in the last 30 years, is talk to you about the weather. But for some reason, it becomes this crazy, outrageous thing because he is who he is. And like I said, a conversation like that couldn't be more normal. And so there's just this weird thing around celebrities that even the simple things in life are, you know, now crazy. Like, you know, like in Us magazine, you know, they'll have all kinds of pictures of, like, celebrities going and getting coffee. Like, big deal. Like, really? Like, that's interesting.
What are some of the differences for you between acting as a child and acting now as an adult?
It was interesting. I mean, when I was younger, it was kind of, it was just more about, I had a lot of energy. And like I said, I enjoyed attention, or at least the good kind of attention that came with being on stage. And so, and that was really all it came from. And they kind of, a lot of the things I did when I was younger was literally just kind of the, you know, when you're a child actor, the most important thing is you have to know your lines. It's amazing. Like, that's all they really care about when they're casting a kid, is know your lines. And so my father, you know, for everything that he was still a very clever man. And so one of the things he did for the audition process was, you know, they'd send me the script and they'd say, oh, do scene 22 and scene 12 or whatever. And they're very, very short, simple scenes. So what he'd do is he'd go through the entire script and find the two longest speeches and two longest, hardest scenes and have me memorize. Because I had a pretty good memory and I remembered the whole thing. And so when I got into the room, me being a cute little 9-year-old, they say, hey, can you do scene 12? And I go, oh, wait, but I studied scene 30, you know? And they'll go, oh, it's okay, little kid. Just do what you studied. And then I go out and I reel off this long thing. And the next thing I know, I have the part, you know? And so it was, like I said, it was more about having a lot of energy and learning your lines, basically. Whereas now it's different, you know? It's you definitely can't just do that, you know? And so, no, I mean, I try to bring more to my work. I mean, you try, you know, I'm definitely a more experienced human being. And so I just try to bring those kind of things to the table and just try to, you know.
And you get to choose your roles now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, after a while, I mean, I wasn't choosing anything. It was just kind of like, oh, by the way, don't make any plans this summer because you're doing a movie and things like that. So now I'm in a position where I'm making my own choices. I'm putting stuff out there that I want out there, that, you know, and so it's cool. And so I just try to do different kinds of things. And, you know, I just try to do good work. That's all.
Macaulay Culkin will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Shocking, and nothing shocks anymore. The message read as it washed ashore. Skies turn black as my eyes look down. Written on the back of these words I found. We'll inherit the earth, but we don't want it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, presenting the 3-disc deluxe edition DVD of Mystic River, starring Sean Penn, Tim Robbins, and Kevin Bacon. From 6 Degrees Records, presenting the new self-titled release from Brazilian pop singer Bebel Gilberto. More information at 6degreesrecords.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, no dancing, no rock music. We talk with writer-director Brian Donnelly about the Christian high school he attended, which helped inspire his new movie, Saved. And we continue our interview with Macaulay Culkin, one of the film's stars.
Personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Macaulay Culkin. He's starring in the new film comedy Saved. He's returned to films after leaving the industry for several years. He became famous as a child for his starring role in the 1990 movie Home Alone. Here's a scene from early in the film in which he's fighting with his mother, played by Catherine O'Hara.
There are 15 people in this house. You're the only one who has to make trouble.
I'm the only one getting dumped on.
You're the only one acting up. Now, get upstairs.
I am upstairs, dummy. The third floor?
Go.
It's scary up there.
Don't be silly. Fuller will be up in a little while.
I don't want a super Fuller. You know about him. He wets the bed. He'll pee all over me. I know it.
Fine. We'll put him somewhere else.
I'm sorry.
It's too late. Get upstairs.
Everyone in this family hates me.
Then maybe you should ask Santa for a new family.
I don't want a new family. I don't want any family. Families suck.
Just stay up there. I don't want to see you again for the rest of the night.
I don't want to see you again for the rest of my whole life. And I don't want to see anybody else either.
I hope you don't mean that. You'd feel pretty sad if you woke up tomorrow morning and you didn't have a family.
No, I wouldn't.
Then say it again. Maybe it'll happen.
I hope I never see any jerks again.
Was it your parents' wishes or your own wishes to start acting and to go into movies?
It kind of just happened. It's this weird thing. When I was 6 years old, I started when I was four. I did some, like, local community theater things and things like that. But when I was 6 years old, we got a family friend of ours lived around the corner from us, and she was a stage manager at this off-Broadway theater called the Ensemble Studio Theater here in New York. And so they were doing this play, and they needed, a six-year-old boy. And so, I'm third of seven. I'm this big Irish family. And so she figured, heck, there's that big family. There's got to be someone the right age and the right gender for this part. And so she kind of just comes on over and plucks me out, and I go to the audition, and then I think at some point I ended up on the table, I think, just kind of doing my lines, standing on top of a table. The next thing I know, I got the part, and kind of just all went from there, really. It all happened really, really fast from that point, because I did that. It was like a one-month program, and then the New York Times reviewed it, and then I did, I think, two or three more programs with the Ensemble Studio Theater, and then literally jumped right into my first movie, and then it's kind of the next one and the next one and the next one, and then by... I think my fourth movie was Uncle Buck. And then from that point on, it was kind of just everything was almost in this kind of semi-cruise control because on the set of that, kind of John Hughes, who also wrote the Home Alone movies, wrote that. And so kind of got the idea for the Home Alone movies from this whole thing and kind of had me in mind for it, but couldn't give me the part because he wasn't directing it. And so I had to meet with Chris Columbus. And yeah, and the next thing I know, I nailed that one down, and the rest is, shall we say, history.
It's so easy, I think, to become a praise junkie when you're a kid, if people are praising you a lot.
Yeah, I really wasn't so much. I wasn't, my parents were pretty good overall. Like, they never told me how much money I was making or things like that. All that stuff kind of was news to me. And when I turned 18, I found out how much money I'd made. And
weren't you reading the newspapers? I mean, I knew how much money you were making.
Yeah, but you know what? No one does. That's the whole thing. People still don't. You should hear the kinds of numbers people throw out. I mean, they're either way too high or way too low.
Oh,
I don't
okay.
know. There's all kinds of numbers being thrown out there. I don't release my financial records. It's not something that's all that important. I mean, yes, it's important. I'm definitely glad I have the money, but at the same time, it's not like something I don't release my numbers to Forbes magazine or something like that. But it wasn't like, it wasn't like I was doing it for even the gratification. I was just having a blast. I enjoyed the people on set. I liked working with Chris Columbus. I liked, I love the stunt people. They were always my favorite, I had a good time on set. And so
when did that
really
start to change? When did the good time start to not be?
You know what?
So good?
I always liked the people on set. I always liked the hair and makeup people. I always liked the wardrobe. They were always really cool people, and they always really got it. They understood the position that I was in, really. And so, it wasn't even that. It was just kind of like I needed a break. And I remember I said this to my father, and he kind of just wasn't listening. The next thing I know, I'm on the next set. And then I started kind of telling anyone who'd listen. But, obviously I was wrong because no one was listening. And it was kind of this crazy thing. And so when my father was out of the picture and I was in a position to say, I don't want to do this anymore, I did. And so I went to whoever was listening or whoever was out there and just said, listen, you can call it retirement. You can call it a break. You can say I quit. It doesn't really matter because it's yours now. It's not mine. you guys can, you know, that Macaulay Culkin public persona is yours. You can do whatever you want with it. I'm going to go to high school, and I'm going to do whatever else from there. But I'm probably never going to act again, and that's it. You know, I hope you made your money, because there's no more coming from me.
When you were young and getting paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars for movie roles, did you have a sense of what was riding on you financially, not just your family, but, like, the director's future, the movie company's future, you know, and all the people working for them? I mean, the movie had to be a success. Your name had to really
hold I know.
Up.
I know. There was this weird kind of thing. People were kind of building this odd industry around me, and it was kind of this weird thing. And, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess they tried their best to shelter me from a lot of that stuff, but at the same time, you can't really hide from that, you know, just the overall pressures of it. But it wasn't anything that, like, made me crack or, you know, shattered me emotionally or something. It was just kind of, it was, honestly, it was at a point where I almost didn't know any better. You know, I mean, I understood that other nine-year-olds weren't doing the same things I was, but at the same time, it wasn't like I knew what Little League was like, you know, or what summer camp was like. I mean, this was my life, and so I didn't really know anything else, so you know, I mean, part of it was, like, a little too much, and that was one of the things why I got away. But it wasn't something I was consciously saying to myself, you know, like, oh, gosh, you know, I really hope we make that, you know, we make that $50 million so the studio will hire me for their next movie. Because at that point, I really didn't care.
You said that your father really pushed you. What are some of the things you think he did wrong in terms of how hard he pushed you or what he pushed you to do?
It's funny. You know, it's one of these things where, I don't know, I mean, people kind of have this weird, you know, this weird thing about me and my father, at least our relationship. They're always kind of like, oh, you know, isn't that sad that, you know, you don't really see your father anymore or anything like that. And it's like, you know, and that everything turned out the way that it did. But what people don't understand was that it was always like this, that, like, you know, he was not a good guy long before we were rich and famous. It was kind of just a part of his personality. And from a very early age, I pretty much knew that, you know, I was, you know, either he was going to be gone or I was going to end up moving out of the house very early. It was one or the other. And I knew that from a very early age, before fame, before money, before anything. And so
what was it that he did that made you realize
he just
that?
Honestly, I wish it was that easy. I wish it was I could point out to one incident or one thing and say that was it. I mean, he was just not a good person. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to understand. I mean, later on, I mean, it was like, you know, I was making who knows how much money, and I was sleeping on the couch in the living room. Like, I didn't even have a bed. I didn't have a room or a bed. I mean, you should have saw his room, and you should have saw the size of his bed and his television and things like that. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't about making me, you know. You know, it was kind of more just putting you in your place and making sure that you knew who was in charge of the whole thing. And it's kind of like, and he played those games with you, and he was always playing those games with you. And so, you know, like, you know, even from a very early age, I knew what kind of person he was. And I knew, you know, I watched him very closely. I wanted to make sure how I wasn't with my children and how I did not want to treat my wife and things like that. I mean, I knew that from a very early age. I mean, I remember he was the first person I ever cussed at, ever. I was like 4 years old, and, you know, I don't know, I forgot what he was doing or what I was doing. But, yeah, I told him to F off. I couldn't believe it, you know, like, wow. I didn't even believe it then. I was like, wow, I was like 3 or 4 years old, and that came out of my mouth. It was just like, but that was our relationship. That was the way it was.
Do you worry that as you say this, he's listening now and he feels bad hearing this?
There's a distinct possibility, you know, and that's a part of it, you know. I mean, I try, you know, it's just one of these things where it's like, it's hard not to talk about him because everyone's always asking, and I'm not going to, you know, I don't hold back, you know, I talk very candidly about him. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to encourage him, you know, because he's far away and that's a good thing.
You know, there's so many child stars who just are emotional cripples by the time they reach adulthood. You seem to have, like, emerged okay.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, I understand that I'm a part of, like, some weird fraternity and some weird kind of convention or you know, group of cliches or whatever. And, you know, I understand that. But at the same time, I don't, you know, I'm aware of it, but I don't try to, I don't fight it.
Are you really okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. No. No, man, I feel good. I think, you know, and a lot of that had to do with me taking some time off and me getting away from everything, you know. And just, I feel like I'm a strong person because of it. I know what I want out of life, and I'm not kind of just doing this because I don't know any better. I mean, I see a lot of, you know, not a lot, but, I, you know, there's a good amount of these child actors or former child actors who who trying to make that transition into adulthood, but never really took the time to live. It never really took the time to exist. And so how do you expect someone to act like a human being when they've never had the chance to be a human being?
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Macaulay Culkin is starring in the new movie Saved. Coming up, we'll meet the director and co-writer, Brian Donnelly. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking with Macaulay Culkin, who stars in the new film Saved, a comedy set in a Christian high school. My guest, Brian Donnelly, directed and co-wrote the movie. Reviewing Saved in the Chicago Reader, Jonathan Rosenbaum wrote, quote, Brian Donnelly's first feature is audacious and likable, not only for its satirical treatment of fundamentalist Christian teenagers and a couple of their elders, but also for its sympathy toward them. It's been a long time since I've seen a teen movie as lively, as unpredictable, as generous, and as tough-minded as this one, unquote. Save was produced by Single Cell, the company co-founded by Michael Stipe of the band R.E.M. Brian Donnelly, welcome to Fresh Air. What gave you the idea of doing a high school comedy about cliques and gender confusion, teen pregnancy, a rock band, but setting it at a Christian high school?
I think we sort of attacked it from a lot of different angles. I had to write a script while I was at grad school at AFI. So one of the first rules about writing
American Film Institute,
yeah. One of the first rules of writing is you write about what you know. And I had gone to a Catholic elementary school, a Jewish summer camp, and a Christian high school. So I was sort of familiar with this world. And that was interesting to me. I also had, it was right around the time that Columbine was happening and the Bush was getting elected. And so that was interesting to me. And I realized sort of all these kids sort of were expressing their faith really openly in sort of mainstream America. And that was different from when I had gone to a Christian high school. And the other sort of approach was loving teen movies, having grown up on John Hughes movies, and sort of taking the idea, like, what if you did sort of a John Hughes-style movie and had subversive undertones and, you know, sort of had everything in the movie that you would never have seen in those movies. So it was kind of that was how we approached it when we started writing it.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, you're satirizing religion in it, but the people at the end of the film, I mean, they still have faith. What you're really satirizing in a way is the self-righteousness and the way that certain religious people use their faith to justify selfishness, jealousy, and pride, saying that it's all for the sake of Jesus.
Well, it was really, you know, taking a look at fanaticism and zealotry, you know, and sort of putting in the microcosm of a high school, which seemed like kind of the best way to address that, because mm-hmm. when you're young, you're sort of more open to a lot of different ideas, but you're also more vulnerable. So that's sort of where that came from.
When you were going to Christian high school, were most of the students in the school, did they want to be there? Did they want to be like full-time Christians, if you know what I mean? Or were they often rebelling against the teachings in the school?
There wasn't a lot of rebellion. There was a lone Jewish girl that went to my school.
There's a character like that in the movie.
Yep, Cassandra. Everything uh-huh. in the movie is based on fact, uh-huh. personal experience, or extensive research, which was really, really important to me when I was making the film. But so there was this lone Jewish girl, people were always trying to get her saved. And she was very tough in this atmosphere. I have no idea why she went to the school, probably a similar circumstance to my own. But so that was sort of interesting. And I remember there was this other sort of rebellious girl who she was the first girl I ever kissed. And, you know, 5 years later, she turned out to be, you know, big lesbian. So it was kind of a very interesting environment to grow up.
What were some of the rules that you had to follow in your high school?
In my high school, we couldn't dance. We couldn't be more than 10 inches from the opposite sex. Girls' skirts had to be 3 inches from their knee if they were kneeling. So it was pretty strict. It was much stricter than the current movement, you know, sort of the Jesus Rocks movement, which is, you know, it's such a mirror for pop culture. It's really hard almost to tell the difference sometimes if you're, you know, attending one of these assemblies or one of these rallies or rock concerts. So that's a huge difference from my experience.
Were there school dances in which you were allowed to get closer than 6 inches to someone of the opposite sex?
No dancing allowed. Our senior prom was a puppet show at the Peter Pan Inn, so we were safe.
My guest is Brian Donnelly, and he co-wrote and directed the new movie Saved, which is a comedy set in a Christian high school. I want to play a scene from Saved, and this is a scene in which the whole student body is assembled in the auditorium. The girl band, the Christian girl band, has just performed. And now Pastor Skip is coming in, and he's the pastor who thinks he's really down with the young people. And he comes in by doing a kind of somersault, by doing a flip. And then he starts, you know, talking in all this hip-hop language because he's so hip. So let me play that scene.
Welcome to the first assembly of the year. Give it up to the Lord. Jesus is in the house. Let's get our Christ on. Let's kick it Jesus style. Y'all want to walk with the ultimate rebel, right? The ultimate CEO, yeah. Biggest celebrity of them all. Who's down with G-O-D?
I'm down with the G-O-D, that's right.
All right. Jesus rules. Jesus rules.
Jesus rules. Jesus rules.
Jesus rules.
And that was Martin Donovan as Pastor Skip, a scene from the new movie Saved. Brian, did you ever see anything quite like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that character and that sort of assembly is a mix of actual assemblies and also sort of larger Christian rallies, youth groups, Christian concerts. That there is a certain setup that's very similar to all of them. And Pastor Skip character is sort of a creation of a bunch of different sort of young youth pastors. A little bit of Carmen, who's on TBN. He's sort of this pastor who, through the years, he's been around for maybe 15 years, but with every sort of change in pop culture, he changes with it. Like he was hip-hop, he did rap, he did disco. He's sort of kind of all over the place, and so I sort of found that fascinating. And they do, like I said earlier, it's such a mirror for pop culture that they really sort of have adopted so much of the language and the style of, you know, contemporary culture that, you know, you do find a lot of the preachers kind of talking in this awkward, cool, you know, language.
There's a lot of pop culture that has its parallel in Christian pop culture. So there's like a lot of Christian rock bands and metal bands and punk bands, and there's probably Christian hip hop bands.
All of that.
What were some of the surprising things that you found in Christian pop culture when you were doing research for the movie?
I think I don't know if ironic's the right word, but you know, there's this whole sort of concept of not idolizing anyone because it's a sin. But you go to these concerts and you have these bands and you have all these kids sort of screaming for the band. And a lot of the bands, because they're really conscious of that, don't have pictures of themselves on the T-shirt. They use symbols. So it's sort of a way of addressing that. But I found it sort of an interesting conflict, you know, within that community. The other thing that's really important to say about this film is the fundamentalist community is so varied that it's really hard to say fundamentalists are like this, because we'd go to a Christian rock concert, say in Anaheim, and there'd be Christians protesting the Christians inside. And, you know, you have, you know, Jerry Falwell just called the movie the most hateful movie to come out of Hollywood in years. But I just did an interview with Christianity Today with like a pastor, a teacher, and a student, and they loved the movie. So it's a very, you know, it's a very diverse community that I don't think there's a hardcore center of it.
Now, I read that scenes that you wanted to shoot in a church, after the church that you had selected as a location found out more about the script, they asked you to leave?
It's funny, I always tell this story, but somehow, somewhere early on, someone asked Michael Stipe what the film was about, and he said it was like a vampire movie, but the Christian teens are vampires. So that was all over the internet. So when we were, you know, actually shooting the film and looking for locations, and if people typed in save, that was the quote that came up. And we, you know, we lost locations and we lost, you know, Christian music because of it. Sometimes it wasn't the script, sometimes it was just the scene, and I can understand anyone reading a certain scene out of context, it could be disturbing. And also, it's really hard to tell the tone of a film by reading a script. So I think that, I think when people see the movie, I think they're actually surprised at how, it's funny, but it's also gentle, it's sweet, it's very affirming. I always say it affirms and offends, you know, it has sort of a mixture of both those things, but yeah, we definitely lost locations.
So what church did you finally get?
It was a Unitarian church, and those guys were great. I mean, we shot the exterior of the church, and we shot the interior scene where Mary sort of questions the validity of the Virgin Mary, you know, having a miraculous birth.
My guest is Brian Donnelly. He directed and co-wrote the new movie Saved. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, early in the morning our song shall rise to thee. Holy, 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 merciful and mighty, God in three persons, blessed Trinity. Holy, 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 all the saints adore thee, casting down their golden crowns around the glassy sea. Cherubim and seraphim falling down before thee, which were and are and evermore shall be. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, all thy works praise thy name in earth and sky and sea. Holy, holy, holy.
My guest is Brian Donnelly. He directed and co-wrote the new movie Saved, a comedy set in a Christian high school.
Has Saved been a difficult film to market because it could be perceived as very controversial by some Christian fundamentalists? On the other hand, I could see a lot of Christian fundamentalists, teenagers particularly, really loving it.
I think it's been a real challenge for MGMUA, and I think they've done a pretty amazing job. I mean, sort of their approach has been, I've been at like every single film festival. It's been screened for, you know, gay kids. It's been screened for cinephiles, it's been screened for the religious community, it's been screened for, you know, at regular, you know, average Joe people. We've screened for, I mean, we've done everything we can to get the word out, or MGM's done everything they can to get the word out about the movie. And it's a little bit confusing because, like I said, the Christian community is so diverse, so I know that they've gotten some slack for presenting the film to a Christian audience. But what I don't think people realize is that there is a large portion of that audience that really embraces this movie.
Do you think that the Passion of the Christ is affecting the marketing of the film or affecting how the film will be perceived?
You know, I think absolutely. We had no idea about the Passion of Christ when we made the movie. And because of Passion of the Christ, we've gotten so much attention that I'm not sure we would have had it not been released. So I mean, I think we didn't set the release date because of the Passion of the Christ. It was all sort of very coincidental. But I noticed, like, on the chat boards, a lot of people from Passion of Christ chat boards are on the Save chat board. So there's definitely this dialogue going on that I think that opened up for us.
What's the dialogue been like? Have you heard?
The dialogue, it's amazing. We're getting, like, what's really kind of amazing to me is we're this little $5 million film that we shot in 28 days that no one made any money on, that I don't think people we're even sure how it would be received into the world. So, like, right now we're like the number 7 top movie on IMDb, and that's sort of with no advertising and not a lot of awareness about the movie.
That's the Internet Movie Database.
Yes, because it's my first film, I obsessively Google everything about the film every single night.
Uh-huh.
Literally every night, it's sick. But the dialogue is really interesting because most of the controversy is coming from people who haven't seen the film. But sort of beyond the film itself, a lot of the dialogue is between, you know, Christian kids and kids who are secularists. And, you know, there's just sort of this dialogue going back and forth. Like, well, I went to school like this. My friends are Christian and they were really cool. Or, you know, I went to school like this and Christians were really mean and it was awful. And I mean, it's just back and forth. I think we're getting hits like every 20 minutes now on the website, which is and some of the stuff is scathing and mean, and you know, talking about this film is made by, you know, a New York Jew and Michael Stipe, who's an atheist, and you know, and it premiered at the Jewish Schmooze Fest in Park City, and just like really anti-Semitic stuff, and it's a very bizarre thing to read at night.
May I ask you about your faith? If you consider yourself to have faith, to practice, any form of religion?
You know, it's always changing. I mean, I wouldn't say after, it was a really odd experience because I had a lot of faith when I was making the film. I mean, I would pray every day. I'd had this very close connection, making sure I was always doing the right thing, that I wasn't going too far, that, you know, that, so I had this, I felt like I had this really close relationship with, you know, God while I was making the movie. And then like 9/11 happened and the war happened, and I started like reading different books about, you know, Iraq and different policies, and I just totally lost faith, which was really interesting to me because, you know, I was like, well, I think your first goal, job as a human being, is personal responsibility and kindness, and that you shouldn't rely on being punished or going to hell or, you know, going to heaven. Like, you just have that, it's an innate responsibility that you have to be responsible for. And so it was kind of weird for me to live in a world where, you know, for a period of time, I didn't believe in God. But, you know, the whole time you think you don't believe in God, you're constantly having dialogue with him. So it's kind of a strange experience. And it's only been recently where, you know, I've just sort of opened myself up to it again. I mean, it's a very, you know, I find it very confusing.
Mm. And is the fact that you find it confusing one of the reasons why you wanted to make the movie?
Absolutely. Because I think there, you know, there are so many different religions in the world. And, you know, Mike, you know, you... Again, I go back to that line, they can't all be wrong, but they can't all be right, you know? I mean, they can't all be right, but they can't all be wrong, right? Because it just makes so much sense to me, and I think it's so dangerous to say that there is just one way to find God and to judge people on that.
Brian Donnelly directed and co-wrote the new movie Saved. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. We're delighted to welcome back our engineer, Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross. We'll end with the closing credit music from Saved, performed by Mandy Moore, one of the film's stars, and Michael Stipe, one of the producers.
I may not always love you, long as there are stars above you. You never need to doubt it, I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be. Would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of Garden State, starring Zach Braff and Natalie Portman, Tuesday night at 9, and from Warner Home Video, presenting the 3-disc deluxe edition DVD of Mystic River, starring Sean Penn, Tim Robbins, and Kevin Bacon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist James Bamford. He's written extensively on the National Security Agency. His new book is called A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.